fact is that some of these investment choices are not on the up and up. They'll take your money and they will put it in a company knowingly doing wrong things in the world or hurting Islam. So, you know, if you think you're getting a purist view, you have to be careful. Now, that's not to say that all investment in these funds is a bad thing, but I think it needs to be examined. But I fear our whole financial system's on the verge of collapse anyway. And that my personal goal would be for every single person listening to me to have physical silver and physical gold as their savings account right now. That would be my advice, because the way things are heading, only physical gold and silver in your possession are going to be significant hedges against the problems we face.
The next one says, on Tuesday, Daryl said that Putin was also backed by Zionists. Do you think that the Zionists want to destroy Russia to destroy the Americans?
Well, I think that the Zionists controlled Russia since 1917 when they sent over their people from New York City with $20 million. And now that's $20 million of 1917 money. And 4,000 Jews that ultimately took over the country, they've never relinquished control. And they already control America. So, you know, they've got a eugenics plan in the works here. Yeah, maybe the plan is for us to battle each other to reduce populations or whatever. That part of the story I'm still sussing out. And I'm trying to bring forward as many documents and as much proof as I can that brings that story clearer into picture here, into focus. We're not, you know, I can tell you one thing. What I witnessed about Georgia and the rest of it was pure nonsense and theater. And if you look at it with a rational eye, you'll come to the same conclusions that myself and many others have.
I'm going to move on, and it says, Salams, Jazakallah for the awesome program. Want to know, did Daryl lay his hands on the book which is called Dajjal by Ahmed Thompson? It explains everything in detail and the entire New World Order.
I don't like using the word New World Order because that kind of deflects the culprits here, and it happens to be Zionist criminal Judaism and their henchmen. So I stay away from New World Order as a way of describing them. But no, I haven't read that book. I'm sorry.
The next one says, Salams, welcome to Mr. Daryl. Let us not say all Western people are anti-Islamic. I know non-Muslims who don't agree with America and Israel. Mr. Daryl is one of them.
Well, thank you. What we need to do here is break down the barriers. And I as well as I do, there are good and bad in every group. And you can say that about Islam. You can say that about Christianity. You can say it about Hinduism. It doesn't matter where you look in the world. There are people making bad decisions, and some people making evil decisions, and there's others making good. What we need to do is remove the barriers between groups so that we can actually focus on who's doing this to us. And as long as we keep these barriers up, we're in trouble. I mean, you know, they're very good at building these hatred walls, these people. This is what they do to control us. You hate this group. This group hates you. Hate the Latinos in America. They hate the blacks. The blacks hate the whites. The whites hate the... This is what they do. Women hate men. Gays hate non-gays. It's all about who hates who and who can... It's a manipulation. We need to stop thinking in these terms. We need to start thinking about all the human family as one, because we need to come together to stop this crime wave. We need to.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, Daryl, at the end of the day, when one looks at the entire world, it's just in one big mess, and, you know, it's just gone bonkers.
If you'd have told me this 10 years ago, I'd have said, you need a rubber room. There's just no way I would have believed that this was the state of affairs of my world. You know, for so many generations, human beings around the world have been victims, and they didn't know why. For the first time in many generations, the world is learning why. We've had wars, we get genocide, we have murder, we have mayhem, we have starvation. We're learning why, aren't we?
Absolutely. And you know, just the other day you and I were talking, and we told the figure you gave me, I think, was what, 130 million people
yep.
that were killed.
That's right.
Right, we're going across to the next caller. We've got Abu Bakr online. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam. Just to follow up on the SMS you got about the Sharia compliant indexes. Sorry, Daryl, on Tuesday night you were talking to your guest Andrew about the Oppenheimer family controlling 51% of the Johannesburg.
54%, I believe.
Yes, and could you explain to listeners how much more control that the Zionists have over the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and World Stock Exchanges? And secondly, the link, the organization called OFI, which is the Accounting and Auditing Organization for Islamic Financial Institutions. Its annual conference last year was co-sponsored by the World Bank and the IMF. And could you explain, sort of what influence the World Bank and IMF has, over... like, for instance, that OFI organization and on third world countries?
Well, okay, the stock exchange in South Africa and the world, for that matter, are principally controlled, operated, run by interests that are moving right back to the same group we've discussed. Their specialization that they've concentrated on is money. Money makes the world go round, ladies and gentlemen, and they control it. You know, the interesting thing that and everyone says that I don't base my life on money. Well, if money can buy you food and you've got none, you all of a sudden pay attention to it. The saddest part is that since they run the New York Stock Exchange and they run London, by extension they run the rest of the world's financial exchanges. If Wall Street gets a cold, the rest of the world gets pneumonia. But now, moving to South Africa, take a look at the majors, the gold majors, the platinum majors, the nickel mines, the bauxite, copper, everything. And then do your due diligence and find out what shell company or what principal holder is of that. And then find out if your Islamic fund is holding some of those major investments. Find out if Mr. Oppenheimer's trust fund is not in charge of them, Barrick and Anglo and the rest of them. The simple truth is that they go through Pan Africa and they own. I said earlier on that Aurelian was being over in South America. They've got their tentacles reaching into Ecuador's mining industry. You can't imagine the breadth and width of their control when it comes to finance. It's just, and I wouldn't, right now, ladies and gentlemen, all that stuff is really going to come under pressure. The day it happens, I don't know. But again, I would be recommending that everybody hold physical silver and gold. Physical. This is my recommendation to the listening public.
Well, I suppose, Daryl, you're going to be covering that in the next hour. I've just got just another two text messages before I've got to close the program. This one says, Salams, has Daryl written a book? Could we have the title? Have you written a book, Daryl?
No, but I was helpful in putting together a timeline on the Rothschild family. It was done by a guy named Anonymous Andy and myself. His name is Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. He took the rest of the work that we did and he turned it into a book. And I endorsed the findings of the Synagogue of Satan, which is the book that he wrote, wholeheartedly. It will give you a complete breakdown of the history of these criminals, going back as far as 300 to 400 years, and how we got into the mess we're in. It is spot on. This
intellectual challenge on CII.
Look at the majors, the gold majors, the platinum majors, the nickel mines, the bauxite, copper, everything. And then do your due diligence and find out what shell company or what principal holder is of that. And then find out if your Islamic fund is holding some of those major investments. Find out if Mr. Oppenheimer's trust fund is not in charge of them, Barrick and Anglo and the rest of them. The simple truth is that they go through Pan Africa and they own. I said earlier on that Aurelian was being over in South America. They've got their tentacles reaching into Ecuador's mining industry. You can't imagine the breadth and width of their control when it comes to finance. It's just, and I wouldn't, right now, ladies and gentlemen, all that stuff is really going to come under pressure. The day it happens, I don't know. But again, I would be recommending that everybody hold physical silver and gold. Physical. This is my recommendation to the listening public.
Well, I suppose, Daryl, you're going to be covering that in the next hour. I've just got just another two text messages before I've got to close the program. This one says, Salams, has Daryl written a book? Could we have the title? Have you written a book, Daryl?
No, but I was helpful in putting together a timeline on the Rothschild family. It was done by a guy named Anonymous Andy and myself. His name is Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. He took the rest of the work that we did, and he turned it into a book. And I endorsed the findings of the Synagogue of Satan, which is the book that he wrote, wholeheartedly. It will give you a complete breakdown of the history of these criminals, going back as far as 300 to 400 years, and how we got into the mess we're in. It is spot on. This man's work was meticulous, and his sourcing was fabulous. And you need to take a look at that book to really get a good education.
The next one, and the final one actually, says, are not the Rockefellers fighting the Rothschilds?
No, absolutely not. They're working together.
Well, Daryl, on that note, a few last words from you. I know you've got another hour on CII.
Yep.
I'm going to have to get onto my bicycle and get home. But just some final words from you, Daryl.
Well, I would like everybody in the listening audience to know that tunes into your show, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a truth teller. I look forward to when you return to the airwaves after your Ramadan vacation here, your Ramadan spiritual month. I want you to know that during the month of Ramadan, they've allowed me, quite miraculously allowed me, to do a Saturday broadcast in the afternoons, because I do think, aside from the spiritual requirements that everyone has, there is a spiritual requirement to know what their families are facing. And I think coming together as human beings is part of what you all are going to discuss this Ramadan, if I'm not mistaken. It's about showing kindness throughout the world you all live in. And I have to say that I'm honored to be able to come on your program and share these facts and these truths with such an important audience.
Well, we've been honored to have you on as well, Daryl. And, personally from my side, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on for the last 2 hours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, that brings us to the end of the last edition of the Intellectual Challenge, just before the holy month of Ramadan. And really, it was quite enjoyable. But just before I leave you with the month of Ramadan, just 2 days away, I think I need to take this opportunity of wishing all our listeners well during the month of Ramadan.
No, you can't take it with you when you go. Oh, no, you can't take it with you when you go. Can't understand why you keep holding on. Just cause you can't take it with you. No, you can't take it with you. Yes, you can't take it with you when you go. Oh, when you go. Cause there's one thing that matters when you're walking down that street. Is the good and bad that you sent for in your book of deeds. So make sure that you're ready.
This is CII.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to another installment of the French Connection. Today's date is the 29th day of August, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you all with me here again for another installment of this most important broadcast. Those of you who have just listened to Inat Wadi and myself, listen to the discussion we had, the callers that we took. A lot of questions about finance and money, a lot of questions about the state of the Islamic investment world, the state of finances in general. And of course, I have a person I have been working with for some time on these issues, among other things. We've talked about a lot of issues together, but the financial mess that we are facing right now is nothing short of catastrophic, in my view. It has been long in coming. Debt-based fiat currencies and money system have mushroomed and ballooned from the beginning of the last century till now. And to me, after looking at it with a jaundiced eye, if you'll allow, has shocked me that the system has been able to hold itself together this long. But as all things pass into history, so will these fiat currencies that are right now hanging on a knife's edge, the dollar, the euro, the Swiss franc, it doesn't matter, the pound, the South African rand. They're all fiat currencies, and they're all big in big trouble, and what is there to do about that? I brought on Mohammed Rafiq to discuss this issue for the next 55 minutes here. Mohammed, are you with me?
I certainly am, Darrell. It's good to be back, and assalamu alaikum to the Muslim brothers and sisters out there listening.
Well, you know, Mohammed, it's great to have you back here. You know, this financial nightmare, and it is a nightmare, Mohammed. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, when we start out here, about some of the suffering that is already starting to erupt. I mean, the people in South Africa may not be aware of it, but foreclosure rates in America, people being thrown from their homes, are reaching a level of epidemic level in the United States, but it's already starting to hit the streets of Britain, isn't it?
Well, we certainly have an epidemic level going on in the States, and what you've got to remember, Dan, what people have to realize is that this is happening in spite of an enormous amount of intervention by the Federal Reserve Bank and bringing in new laws and methods to try and keep people in their homes. So in spite of everything that they've tried to do, we've still got a situation where homes are being repossessed at a tremendous rate, and the banks themselves, as a result, are running into financial difficulties. They have financial difficulties because banks don't want houses, now, do they? They want money. They're in the business of money. That's all the bank does, is buy, sell money or borrow and lend money. They don't use assets ordinarily other than money itself. So for them to end up with property is a big problem. What they want is the income stream of the interest payments from that property, and not the property itself, because they themselves have borrowed money, and this is the heart of the crunch now. They themselves, as banks, have borrowed money to lend on to the homeowners. And it means that if those homeowners who've taken on the mortgages can't pay the banks the interest, the banks themselves are struggling to service the money that they have borrowed. And that's why there's two layers which are suffering tremendously. The people who can't afford to pay their mortgages for economic reasons, and then the banks which are collapsing as a result of that, or having great hardship as a result of not receiving those revenue streams, Darrell. And of course now, just starting to happen in the UK. There's other problems out there as well, but this is just one of them.
Well, this is the one with a human face, but the one that's really going to hit us next, and we've discussed this on other programs we've done, is the coupon payments on certain bond obligations, as well as treasury obligations. And what we're seeing today is that the derivative marketplace is running up into the 600, almost 700 trillion, with a T, ladies and gentlemen, dollars. That whole system has no longer has any backing to it. In other words, the securing of that amount of debt has gone bad. And that next phase of failure is going to translate into all kinds of upstaged balance sheets for corporations, for banks, for individuals, for investment houses, for every kind of financial company you can think of, insurance companies. Doesn't matter where you look, cities even that have invested in these things, Mohammed. What we've got is phase two coming, don't we?
We've got phase two, and this particular phase is going to be rather like a tsunami. It's going to come very fast, it's very big, and it's going to hit hard, Darrell. Just looking at the issue of bonds, which is something that you and I, we've been warning people about since the beginning of this year, that at the back part of this year, from sort of September, October, we're going to see an enormous amount of failure in the bond market. Well, I've done some research on the numbers. I've got the numbers, so I hope you're sitting comfortably, Darrell, just on, and everybody else's, because these numbers are incredible. There are, between September and December of this year, $871 billion worth of bonds maturing. Now, when it's maturing, Darrell, obviously you and I, we understand what that means is that whoever owns that bond is looking at getting that capital paid back.
That's right.
ordinarily the people who've issued those bonds, which include big banks, among the issuers, by the way, now, we have, for instance, Merrill Lynch, they're in it for $30 billion, Wachovia Bank are in it for $26 billion, Lehman Brothers into the first quarter of next year, also in it for $20-odd billion. These banks have issued bonds, and effectively, that bond is a promise. It's a piece of paper that says, you're lending me some money, and I promise to pay you back on this date, some point in the future. And during the interim, I'll pay you interest payments. That's fundamentally what the bond is. Now, in 2005, between 2005 and the first half of 2007, there was an enormous amount of short-term financing that went on. In bonds issuing, and these are issued now for the purposes of refinancing in the market. So some of these bonds actually matured 2 years ago, but the bank didn't have the cash at the time.
So they rolled them over. Well, rolling over means that they went back to the same sources and said, look, we'll give you a coupon payment for now, and we'll make the maturity date out into the future. Paying off whoever we have a debt to in the short term, we'll pay them now with that borrowed money, and then just extend the date out into the future.
That's correct, and it's usually with a fresh issue. So between 2005 and the first half of 2007, there were more than $1 trillion worth of short term issues. The bulk of them were set for the third quarter and fourth quarter, and the bulk of that bulk are the fourth quarter of 2008, and some of them are into early 2009.
Wasn't there a big write-down, a big rollover last August, September, when this thing first broke? Everybody ran to the bond market trying to shove paper down into the system so that they could get a grace period, if you will, right before October's real explosion happened.
Well, what's happened, of course, Dale, as you and I have been tracking as it's gone along, is that the ability for banks to go to this window of issuing new bonds for old and extending the repayment period through reissuing and refinancing their position, that dried up, and we've documented that very well in shows earlier in the year, showing how this window's got drier and drier and drier, and there's nothing to go there for. Two of the biggest potential failures are with the corporations Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these big mortgage lenders in the States.
Yeah.
In the fourth quarter of 2008, Darrell, they have bonds maturing between them with a total amount of repayable maturity more than $220 billion, and they just don't have the cash to pay it.
And that's not an American problem. Why don't you describe to the listener how banking has become an international system, and that banks in Germany and banks in Switzerland and banks in South Africa are holding paper on these debts.
Well, the amazing thing is, and it's a very important point now, the internationalization through the computerization of the banking system, it made it possible for this kind of transaction to occur. We actually have people in Europe buying bonds issued by American corporations. And in fact, I believe that the numbers are something in the region of 30% of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae bonds are owned by European owners alone.
That's
so 30%
right.
of everything. So we could say 30% of this $226 billion, using straight line because I can't be absolutely sure, but, you know, just using straight line mathematics, 30% of that, so $70 billion, is owned by companies and investment institutions in Europe, and you see these funds saying we've got $200 billion under management, we've got $50 billion under management, we've got $20 billion under management. Well, of course, what that means is that they've gone and used that money that's been entrusted to them to buy these bonds. $871 billion worth of bonds need refinancing. Now, one figure that I have got on refinancing is for the floating rate. Some of those bonds, they pay a fixed amount now, and others, they're known as floaters in the business.
Yeah.
They pay a variable amount based on various factors that may be linked to Euribor, LIBOR, or some kind of reference rate that goes up and down, and they change the rate every 3 or 6 months or whatever. So these floaters, there are 260, out of that 871 billion, 260 billion of them are floaters. And it's estimated that, according to the professional sources, the most optimistic refinance is 110 billion. So they're saying at least 150 billion in floaters are not going to get refinanced. And of those 260 billion, one bank, Bank of America, is holding $50 billion worth of them. So,
so let's translate this down to the street now. Now, let's say you're a guy who who's living a modest life. You've got a regular paycheck. You're trying to make ends meet with. You've gone out into your world and tried not to get involved in interest-bearing types of investments because you're from the Islamic community or whatever. But you still need somebody to hold different kinds of debts for you so that you can buy a home or you could have a car or whatever it is you've done. What's going to happen on the street level is that companies that you normally relied on to be there for you are not going to be there. They're not going to be there with help for you financially. They're not going to be there with a job for you to produce. In other words, this is going to translate. It's not a ripple effect across the economies of the world. It is, as you stated not a few moments ago, a tsunami coming, and it translates down into the rank and file human on the street as an absolute wipeout.
We're going to get failures as a result of this. The enormity of this collapse, unlike the derivatives market where this is all notional values, we've got to remember that the bond market, that $871 billion was cash lent by people to other people, lent by corporations to other corporations, whatever. It was real cash to start with, Darryl.
Yeah.
And what we're saying is that the people who borrowed that money are unable to repay it because they're suffering so badly already with all the collapse in the derivative markets and all the other collapses. Now they're being told, okay, time for you to pay up the big money. And when they haven't got that, historically this happens all the time. And people don't know it's happening because they just go to the bond market, do a new issue, and borrow long to pay short. So this kind of conduct is going on all the time. But now the window's dried up, people for the first time will start to see how much we've been living on the never-never, how much we've been borrowing and borrowing and borrowing just to keep going. A lot of the state of the world has all come about through this perpetual borrowing and pushing off obligations all the time, for decades in some cases. So that we now have a situation. You know, we used to joke in this country, Darryl, about what we called war loan. During the Second World War, the British government, in order to raise money to pay for the war, issued bonds to people in the UK that they could buy, and the government promised to pay them a coupon of 2% or 3% or 4%, and they were irredeemable. They had no maturity date. So they were so desperate for money, the government said, as long as you hold this paper, we'll pay you 4% per annum every year, but we're never paying the money back. That was the deal. Well, and people laughed about that. You know, who on earth would want to borrow forever and just keep paying and paying and paying? And other people would say, well, why would you want to lend money forever and never get your capital back? But technically, some of the banks, and I know for a fact, like British Telecom, have borrowed on bonds for two decades, and some of the debt that they borrowed 20 years ago still hasn't been paid back because they've technically issued new debt. They've never paid it all off. It's never been paid off. And what we're going to see now is this culture which is built up over decades of borrowing long to pay short. And now that window's closed, we're getting the bill down. Humanity is getting the bill for all this borrowing, for stuff that's been built up for 10, 20 years.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit about, because we are talking to a great number of Muslims across the world, you know, and not me, not from that community. I understand and I'm mindful that there has always been an awareness within Islam that usury would end badly. Actually, the Catholic Church came out against usury in the Middle Ages. They didn't practice it as well. It isn't until the modern era that we see Christianity using usury as well, which is a system that was introduced by the money changers, the money lenders, and the usual suspects, if you'll allow. What is the real lasting effect of this on the Islamic countries, on the nations as a whole, who think because they didn't engage in this, they're not going to become victims? This is something somewhat of a misnomer, Muhammad. Because if I said, oh, because I didn't borrow any money, it's not going to really be my problem. But that isn't true, is it? Everybody that is out there who works for a company, who does anything, is going to find out that their favorite product that they used to buy is no longer in business, or the trucking company that delivered to their town no longer can afford to stay delivery. In other words, there is not going to be a single person in the modern world, regardless of location, that is not going to get slammed by this.
Well, from a theological perspective, Islamically speaking, Darrell, the Holy Quran actually prohibits usury no less than 13 times. So it's very clear to Muslims that if they read the text of the Holy Quran, the prohibition is very clear. And unlike, say, intoxicants, which are prohibited only once, interest is referred to on no less than 13 separate occasions as being prohibited. And one of the statements is interesting from an Islamic perspective, in that it says that Allah has removed all blessing, all barakah from usury. So it doesn't matter if you're Muslim or non-Muslim, although it's not prohibited to somebody who's not a Muslim. What the Quran actually says on it is, it says, it doesn't matter you're Muslim or not Muslim, Allah's saying, Almighty God, our Creator, as we believe as Muslims, is saying, I remove all blessing from this. So it doesn't matter if you're Muslim or not a Muslim, if you get involved in this, ultimately, what you're doing will go bad on you, because it has no blessing in it. We believe that God puts blessing into everything, but he says, I don't put any blessing at all in this, Muslim or non-Muslim. So when we as Muslims stand by and let people get involved in this and not explain to them the errors in the mathematics and why it's socially irresponsible and economically bad, etc., and we let them build their world on it, and then we as Muslims become dependent on that world, rather than standing back and say, hey, you're building a house of cards, we're going to stand back because we know that house is going to collapse. No, they got in the middle of it and said, oh, I'll put a few cards here, and I'll put my family under these cards over there, and I'll put my business under those cards there. Muslims have got involved in it, and they're as much wrapped up in the global financial system now as anybody. You yourself, Dal, pointed out the other day that so much money which has flown into the Muslim world, say from the sale of oil or other types of business activity, has been invested out of the Muslim community.
That's right.
And it's on offer. It's been put with the same institutions which are all starting to collapse everywhere.
That's right. But you see, one of the things that they've been very successful at doing, that the criminals in charge of our world, is globalizing our food delivery, globalizing our resource delivery, whether it be a foodstuff for your animals or a foodstuff for anything. Simple fact is that now you don't have a local provider of sustenance. You have to go to the global marketplace. Because the global marketplace is so tied to this this terrible system that's going bad on us, all of those deliveries are going to cease, is my point. If you're living out in the outskirts of Central Europe or in Ukraine or in Uganda, it doesn't matter where you are, you're going to have trouble surviving what's going to come. I think this is a global catastrophe, Muhammad. I can't see this ending in a good way. This is going to end badly, and I urge people to take a look at just how deep this problem is.
Well, of course, what you've raised there is an important point in respect of the manipulation of the Zionist criminal gang who are behind all of this. What they did do, of course, as you pointed out, is they subsidized cheap imports into an area, so that, say, if you were growing melons in a particular area in your town, all of a sudden these melons turn up from another country, say Brazil, and they're turning up at, you know, one-tenth the cost that you can even produce at.
Yep.
Of course, in reality, these melons are far more expensive because they've just got the transport cost alone. But these people absorbed all of that, and they sold these cheap goods into the local market for an extended period of time, simply to put the local producers out of business. Once the local producers are out of business, the entire community is then dependent on that import, at which
yeah.
point the price starts sliding back up on the import. And of course, if that import gets cut off for whatever reason, how long is it going to take to rebuild all those melon groves? You know, they took decades to grow, and then nobody wanted the produce, and they've all gone bad.
They've done that very thing here in France, Mohammed, to the people raising sheep. They've flooded the market with sheep from halfway across the world in New Zealand at prices nobody could produce a sheep at that lamb at these prices. And what they've done is destroyed the countryside of France. Farmers are bankrupting; they're going bankrupt left, right, and center. Their production is dropping through the floor. People are losing their homes. Suicide and every other kind of social ill that goes along with these kinds of problems are erupting everywhere, and you can witness it in my local neighborhood.
And you have to ask the question, don't you, Dale? How can it possibly be cheaper to rear a sheep in New Zealand and then transport it halfway around the world? I mean, if you look at shipping costs, this stuff is expensive to move around. It has
yep.
to be kept in special refrigerated, even if you slaughter it, it's still got to be kept in either freezer containers or refrigerated ones, usually frozen, because it takes, well, 4 to 5 weeks to travel, and that stuff is frozen the entire time. It has to be kept in a special type of container that can sit on the dockside, that remains refrigerated, running under generators, and all. So expensive, just that alone. You have to understand, people, that it's impossible that that's cheaper. It actually doesn't make sense when you look at it objectively. It's impossible for that to be cheaper. But they've subsidized it. They've lost money on it because they want that local pain. They want that local misery. And that because once the community has suffered that, the ability to even produce its own supply has gone.
Well, this is not just true here in my area of central France. It's true in Britain. It's true. I mean, the farmers in Britain have been devastated. The beef farmers, and they did it through BSE, which is a contrived sickness. They've done it through every kind of thing you can think of. And then on top of that, now what we're facing here is global food shortages on the horizon. People having trouble feeding their families. These are not problems that are in our distant future, but in our near future, Mohammed. The financial system goes belly up. The deliveries stop from these places, these disparate places in the world. And the wheat that you relied on for your local baker to bake bread is not going to be there. And you have no local source for the wheat. What do you do then?
Well, there's nothing you can do because there isn't enough time to start regrowing, to get these resources into a state where they're ready to produce, whether it's, I mean, apple trees, we've lost in the UK, you know, in the south we have an area, a county known as Kent, which historically was called the Garden of England, and we had apple groves down there where we had many species of apple which are unique to the UK, and people would be happy to eat these traditional English apples in the UK as well. We ended up losing the fruit which is produced in this country now. It's served almost as a delicacy if you get an English apple.
Yeah.
We have apples from all around the world, again, New Zealand, South America. We have them from across Europe. But you don't find English apples. But when I was a young boy, we only had English apples because the idea of shipping in apples from another part of the world was just far too expensive anyway.
That's right. And it still is. And but now they've got a monopoly, and it's about building monopolies. Now, Mohammed, I want to open up the phone lines for people to call in to ask us a question. We'll give them time to do that, and I'll let my engineer suss out that that situation, because I think it's important that, that these financial questions can be maybe addressed by you directly with our listeners. Here is the phone number. It is country code 2711-494-7007, and we welcome callers from across the globe and around the world. But, Mohammed, you know, moving into the next situation here where a lot of people are still in denial. And what would you say to them about their next move? I've been telling people that they should, if they've got a savings account, they should convert it into hard assets such as gold and silver. Would you recommend that as a short-term or even a medium-term solution for their savings?
I think a short and medium-term actually holding gold is a very wise thing. You know, the paper currencies, these fiat currencies, are looking very, very shaky at the moment. Gold itself is just going to go up against all currencies ultimately. There's an enormous battle going on with gold between various power groups about what the pricing of it should be, and that battle is still raging on at the moment and will probably rage on for some time. But I would say even in the short term it's worth buying, especially at the price it's at the moment. Of course, it's not always easy to get hold of because demand is so great. I saw just before I came on, Darrell, the Krugerrands, and the entire supply, I think for the next 3 months, has been bought out by a single supplier. And the company that mints them in Africa, in South Africa, has made an announcement today that a single buyer in Switzerland just, I think they bought 6,000 or 10,000 Krugerrands or some very...
It was even more than that. I think it was 70,000.
Was it 70? I forget the order size, but they've completely wiped
out... 5 tons of gold, I think.
Sorry?
5 tons of gold.
Probably. A staggering amount, but bought the whole lot out in a single go. So somebody's somewhere is thinking that this is a good stuff to put your money into, and they're obviously tired of keeping it in... paper currencies which keep going up and down, and people with who've got enough money to have that worry, to be worried about which currency they should keep their money in.
Well, we've got a call, Mohammed Abubakar. You're on the Mohammed Rafiq.
Yes, hi, good evening, Daryl, and Assalamu alaikum, Mohammed.
Walaikum salam.
Okay, yeah. Earlier on in the previous show, I mentioned an organization to Daryl called AOFI, A-A-O-I-F-I, Accounting and Auditing Organization for Islamic Financial Institutions. Now, Mohammed, what I'd like to know is, you know, what's your opinion on this proliferation of the so-called Islamic, in inverted commas, banking and finance and investments? Do you think it's just another form of money lending in disguise, and they just change the terms to, you know, give them fancy Arabic terms, but essentially in substance is this the same as money lending? And my other question is, you know, you're mentioning on this bond crisis. Now, will it implode on the same people who have lent out money? You know, at the end, is it like a zero-sum game? And, will it impact on the people who have been exploiting the, you know, poor people?
Well, coming to the first question, Abubakar, we have a situation where there has been an enormous growth in the Islamic banking and finance world. But, of course, when we look at that objectively, we actually have to understand the word Islamic and what that means. Islamic does not mean halal or Sharia compliant, Sharia compliant being another phrase that they like to use.
Yes.
Halal and Islamic are not the same, not the same thing at all. You
Absolutely.
Can have meat which is halal. But we could have another meat. We could have pork, which was Islamic. It could be Islamic because I perform dhibh on it. I perform the Islamic sacrifice, but on an animal which is prohibited.
Correct.
But I can say it's still Islamic because I perform the Islamic rite. Islamic finance is very much like this, and Islamic banking is very much like this. There are, of all the institutions out there, very few which are sticking to the strict rules of what is actually genuinely halal. And there is a lot of, well, there are six rules here from Islam, we shall apply four of them, and then we can say our product is Islamic. We're not telling people it's 100% halal, because that would be fraudulent. But we will tell them it's Islamic. And this is why, Abu Bakr, the word Islamic is used, and why Muslims are being told to adopt Islamic finance. And what I'm saying is Muslims should have halal banking and halal finance. And that is a completely different proposition. So, yeah. Sorry about that one, Darrell.
No, it's fine. The second question was?
The second question is, who's going to suffer? Well, the lenders are going to suffer in the first instance. So whoever's bought these products, these bonds, and when they don't get paid out, those people suddenly going to find that they're holding paper that's worthless. So whoever's lent the money, effectively been the lender by buying the bond, whoever's effectively lent the money, there's going to be maybe 40% of that 870 billion will get refinanced if they're lucky. That's the most optimistic 300 billion. So there's about $500 billion that people have lent out that they're not going to see coming back. Who they are, it's an interesting question. Bondholders are everything from institutions like the Bank of America, who's going to be suffering terribly, probably going to go insolvent because of this one, I think, Darrell. And, yep. And we'd have like pension funds, endowment funds. I met a lawyer in London yesterday who, she was at, you know, I don't like to guess a woman's age, but let's say that she was towards the back end of her career. And she told me that the only reason she's working today is because her pension fund has become of zero value and it's forced her to stay in work. She actually wanted to be retired already.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are going to be terrible victims in this. And a lot of them, Muhammad, are people who have spent their lives putting nickels and dimes they've saved into a pension so that they do have a time in their life where they don't have to go out and do backbreaking work or you know, get up and try to sustain their lives through hard labor. And those people are not going to get that grace. They're not going to have that time. And for the Americans, it's going to be the worst. But I don't think anybody in the world is going to go unscathed in this mess.
Sorry, one more question, Mohammed. What do you think about the link between the World Bank and AOFI, which is based in Bahrain, which is also the headquarters of the OIC, you know, which is supposedly, made up of 57 so-called Muslim countries, but they can't even get rid of, you know, the Americans in the West out of Iraq or Afghanistan. Yeah, and recently their ambassador, the Bahrain's ambassador, is a Jewish lady who was appointed as a U.S. ambassador.
Well, of course, Bahrain has always been the center of banking clearing in the Middle East. I'm not 100% sure why historically it was so. I do know that when I've opened LC's letters of credit from banks in the UK, and I wanted them accepted when I was doing some supply work into Sudan or other places, I was told in each case, don't get it issued on a Sudanese bank because the banks in London won't accept it. They didn't consider them strong enough or worthy enough. So this was a historical trade thing. What happened is that, you know,